Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 10. Eighth Hole. Scott stared at the listing of the top golfers that was displayed by the kid who had been following them from the start. There was Hanover S. at the top, now 6 under par after 7 holes. He never thought he'd see such a thing. It seemed too bizarre. Right now, he just wanted to get that videotape and replay his moment of glory over and over until everyone around him was sick of it. He had never had a hole-in-one before, and he was beginning to think Ted Lang was right. He'd be able to pull off a great game, but his inner golf voice warned him of double and triple bogeys yet to come, perhaps even today. But to be the leader at this moment filled him with pride.
"Mr. Hanover is teeing off," intoned the red-jacketed man.
"Paul, I need a quack," whispered Scott as he stared at the fairway. The hole curved in a dogleg to the right, and along most of the right side was a giant water hazard. He'd been lucky so far. He was on his second ball of the day, the ball from his hole-in-one safely tucked away to be mounted on a plaque to further commemorate his achievement. Sarah would likely make him hang it in the basement, but he'd have one made nonetheless.
"Can't do it. He'd probably assess you a penalty on the spot."
"Can he do that?"
"Probably. Just a little one."
"It's not the same," warned Paul.
"I need something."
"Hit the ball, Scott. The water's not there."
Scott laughed.
"What water?" he asked.
Paul smiled.
"I don't see no water," he said, adding to the joke.
Scott teed up his brand new duck logo ball and mouthed a duck prayer to himself with a silent quack.
"What water?" he told himself.
"What water?"
He took his practice swings, feeling confident and delighted with how the round was turning out.
"What water? What water?"
He pulled back the club and swung. The ball rose up and out and started a little fade. A little was okay. The water was all the way to the right. Once it hit the ground, the ball would come to rest dry. The fade turned into a pull, a little closer to the water, but still not in danger. Maybe off the fairway in the rough, but that would be fine too. The pull turned into a full-blown slice, and the memory of his tee shot on the second hole returned, except this time he didn't have the relative safety of some tall grass. The ball, which had started out aimed down the middle of the fairway, bounced on the rough 3 yards from the water and landed with a splash in the hazard. Scott let out an "Urgh!" from the tee. He shook his head and turned to find Paul and handed him his driver. The duck was back. Oh boy, was he back. Paul said nothing, knowing Scott already knew the situation. Since it was a lateral water hazard, he'd be allowed to take a drop near where the ball went in. but one penalty stroke would be added to his score. Hopefully, he'd be on or near the green with the next shot, and get it in the hole with two more strokes for a total of five. A bogey. It wouldn't kill him. Paul and Scott both bogeyed their share of holes every time out, but today had been a good streak while it lasted. On in three, Scott droned, voicing the words of encouragement that Paul held back. He didn't mean it, but he really couldn't be that disappointed. He'd missed water on four holes already. 20% wetness was a good thing, at least on the deodorant commercials. Ellie Burke tried to force a smile. Jason was right. This guy had a good run, but now it wasn't looking good. There was still 11 holes to play. One or two bad holes would erase his negative score and put him in the bottom half of finishers in no time. Ellie was angry as well. Angry at the tournament official that had banned Scott's pre-drive quack. It was a silly thing, but it was part of the superstition of golf. Players had little routines or things they said or did to prepare for their shots, and an annoyed, fat, greasy, ignorant, self-important official had denied him his. She pointed her camera and took some footage of the red-jacketed man, mentally composing the commentary she would suggest to Jason if ever this footage made the air. He would turn out to be the bad guy for sure. Jerry Spalding teed up next. He gave Scott a supportive pat on the back. "Tough luck," he commented, knowing exactly what the fellow golfer was feeling. Scott wasn't a great golfer, but he had been rooting for him ever since the fifth hole, and this was a blow to his rhythm and momentum. One bad shot usually led to another, and another, and the more frustrated you became, the more bad shots you made until you had a 13. "You'll get it on," he said, and placed his own ball on the tee. His shot also showed a little fade, but it managed to stay on the fairway, just near the turn in the dogleg, a perfect position to be on the green in two. Pete Baldwin followed. He made no comment to Scott, but he, too, had been secretly rooting for the underdog golfer. Pete knew he had no chance of winning an opportunity to play with the pros, but he was vicariously hoping that maybe Hanover might at least give the hotshots a run for their money. Scott was still way ahead of the rest of the pack, and there was still time to pick up any strokes he might lose here. But he knew the psychological damage that a shot like that played with an amateur golfer's mind. The brain would take over from the muscles, and once one began to overanalyze what went wrong, it only got worse. Pete's shot went straight and a little to the left. His drive was perhaps as long as Jerry's, but he was 30 yards further from the hole thanks to the dogleg in the course. The crowd, which was still growing like a bacterial culture on a petri dish, followed the three and their caddies down the fairway. Scott would shoot next. They reached the spot where his ball splashed into the water. Paul handed him a new ball and Scott carefully rolled it in his hand, rubbing his thumb lightly over the imprinted yellow duck. "You don't see any water, do you?" he asked. He held the ball to his ear and smiled. He said, "What water, Paul?" Paul laughed. "What did I do wrong on my drive?" he asked. "You want the technical explanation or the psychological?" "What's the difference?" "The technical you ain't going to fix. The psychological, on the other hand, is pretty easy." "Then let's make it the psychological explanation." "Okay, Scott. Why are you here?" "To win this tournament." Paul made a nasal buzzing tone. "Eh, wrong answer." "To shoot my best round ever?" Another buzz. "Eh." "To not finish last?" A third strike sounded. "Eh." "You are here to play golf, my friend. Nothing more, nothing less. Enjoy the day, the course, and even the view over this pond. But don't think you're here for anything other than the play." "I'm so stupid." "When you play in a tournament or against other players, you have unneeded pressure on you. When you play golf, it's just you. No one else is here. You can hit it in the water or in the trees or in the hole. As long as you're hitting the ball, you're in the game." Do you get it? I wasn't playing golf, was I? No, you were shooting for another eagle. Sorry to say, it ain't gonna happen. Scott chuckled. He looked across the pond at the green. There was sand behind the green to the left and some in front. Someone who saw the water and who had just hit the ball into it might chip further up the fairway to avoid it. But not a golfer. Not this golfer. 7 iron? 7 iron, agreed Paul. Scott held out his hand with the ball in his palm, glanced at the red-jacketed official to make sure his drop was in the proper area, and let the ball tumble from his fingers. It landed on the thick, tall grass, like it was set up on a tee. He took the club from Paul. For some reason, he thought of Sarah. He loved his golf, and he loved her, and he hoped there was room for both of them in his life. But he would put the clubs away for a while and spend time with his new family. If this was going to be his last game for a while, he'd have fun. He'd been having fun. It always seems fun when you have a good game or a good hole or a good shot. It only took one shot, that was the saying, to bring you back again. He'd be back again, perhaps with a son or daughter in tow to share the peacefulness and tranquility he found here. He lined up the shot and took his practice swings. He hit the ball square, and it sailed over the water. What water? And thumped on the green, rolling to 4 feet away from the pin. Playing golf, said Paul. Scott wondered what his caddying bill was going to be for today. Whatever it was, Paul had earned it. Jerry raised his brow at the shot. Scott was sitting on the green in 3 strokes and potentially 1 putt away from par after plopping one in the pond. It was a pretty good comeback. He had a feeling he'd sink it. Jerry's shot rolled off the back of the green on a little fringe of grass that separated the green and the sand trap. Pete shanked his 8 iron and the ball ended up in the water, 5 yards short of the green. He moved up and dropped a ball and chipped it into the back sand trap, and almost threw another club into the water. His next shot out of the sand rolled well past the pin, almost off the green, and Pete looked about ready to give up. He was still away and would shoot again, this time his 6th stroke. He putted with little concentration, or so it appeared to Scott, and his putt showed it. It ended up 6 feet short of the hole. 2 more putts put him in the hole with an 8. Jerry knocked his ball to within inches of the hole with his 1st putt and sank the next one with a lazy one-handed knockin'. Silence greeted Scott as he replaced his tiny penny with his ball. The green seemed surrounded by people, and more were up at the next tee. The camera was aimed at him, and despite all this pressure, he knew he would make the shot. He had seen the ball go in the hole in a deja vu-like trance. He would par the hole and stay 6 strokes under par. He was playing golf. He was having fun. The cheers were heard all the way up at the scoreboard. Scott Hanover's drive into the water had many observers on edge. Was this hole going to be the start of his downfall? The cheers could mean only one thing. The scorekeeper listened to the report from the 8th hole, and pulled a square number card from his stack, holding it close to his chest until he could hang it on the paired brass hooks. It was a 4. Hanover had parred 8. He was still 6 under and leading his closest competitor by 5 strokes. It was unlikely that many of the best players just teeing off or about to would equal that score for the entire round. A few people started moving. Then more joined them as they realized that the threesome would be teeing off at the top of the hill, just 500 yards away. Some walked and others jogged over to the 9th green. Many hoped to catch a glimpse of a golfer having a tremendous round. Others hoped they would be witnessing the start of his demise. In any case, few wanted to miss it. As they settled in around the green, their attention turned to the top of the hill in the distance. Observers who had been watching the action on the 8th tee from the elevated vantage point were now parting to either side. Before long, a man walked into the empty space. He wasn't wearing tights and a cape. He wasn't glowing with a heavenly aura. He was just a golfer. A golfer having a really good day.
"Shall we take a little walk?" suggested Jake.
"Sure." Gina hugged his arm as they followed the crowd to the ninth green.
"Are you going to sign him?"
"Why not? You know, if he wins, Karen Blakely is going to be really pissed off."
"I know," smiled Jake.
"If he loses, what have you lost?"
"Exactly."
"Aren't these guys supposed to be amateurs?" she asked.
"Yes."
"Then how can they sign up to do anything?"
"Well, technically, they are limited to receiving $500 per appearance or sponsor, and can't accept any cash for a tournament. But physical prizes are okay. And there are always ways to work around it. Delayed payouts until he loses his amateur status. Compensation as a consultant or something like that."
"Sounds like you know your stuff," Gina teased.
"It's coming back. Hey, do you have a cell phone?"
"You know I do." She detached herself and rummaged through her purse and pulled out the tiny black box.
"Here,"
she offered. Jake dialed Jonathan's phone number.
"What's going on?"
begged Jonathan.
"April Weinstein says that Karen Blakely signed Andrew Patterson."
"Yep," answered Jake.
"Jake, I thought you'd get it. I really did."
"Nope."
"Is Gina there?"
"Yep."
"Is your next answer going to be nope?"
Jake had to think about it. It wasn't going to be, but he had to say it.
"Nope."
Jonathan laughed.
"Are you okay?"
"I think I may have a real Cinderella for you. Forget Patterson."
"Forget Patterson?"
"Forget Patterson. He is a favorite. Everyone expects him to win. Think Hanover."
"Think Hanover?"
"What Eric Gunther didn't pull off, this guy might."
"What, some kind of upset?"
"He's finished 8 holes and is 6 under par and shows no signs of dropping away. If he stays there, he's probably going to win."
"Probably?"
"It's still a long shot."
"But if he pulls it off, he'll be a much bigger story than Patterson and a better play for Callaway."
"That's what I'm thinking."
"Is Blakely there?"
"She left a while ago. No sign of her coming back."
"Sign him before she has the same idea."
"It wouldn't look good if she were representing Patterson and Hanover."
"When has that ever stopped her?"
"Never, I guess."
"It sounds like you're back."
"I'm on my way, Jonathan. Thanks for sending me here."
"Hey, I almost screwed it up."
"I think I needed to screw up and realize that the world wasn't going to end. That nobody was going to die. I'm not the guy to represent Patterson anyway. After talking to his caddy and him, I don't think I'd have the stomach for it. But Hanover, he's the sportsman, you know?"
"I hope so,"
Jonathan said.
"Good luck."
"Thanks."
Jake pressed the end button and handed the phone back to Gina.
"I think he's getting ready to shoot," she observed.
They watched as the golfer on the tee stared at the green.
"Your registration is out of date," observed the officer standing next to Karen's convertible. "That's 3 violations."
"3? Whined Karen, before realizing that arguing the matter wasn't going to help.
"Improper use of the shoulder, lack of proper vehicle registration, and failure to use a turn signal."
The cop stared at her through mirrored sunglasses.
"Thought I'd miss that, eh?"
Karen slumped further into her seat.
3 violations at one stop can allow me to impound your vehicle and book you in at the barracks and have you post a $500 bond. Then it's another $750 to get your car out of impound and a $125 towing fee."
"But you don't have to?"
squeaked Karen, hopefully.
"It's a busy day. I'll just write your citations. Consider yourself lucky," she warned.
"Thank you,"
said Karen meekly. As the officer walked away, she muttered an inappropriate description of the female cop under her breath. The policewoman stopped in her tracks. Karen slumped yet further, but the officer continued on. Karen looked at her watch. Patterson would be teeing off any second. The only thing that caused her to smile now was imagining Jake's expression when he found out she had gotten to Patterson first. If only she hadn't been sent out on the Gunther Goose.
Fisher, she muttered. Could he have been behind getting her out there?
Well, it didn't matter. Patterson and the Calloway accounts were hers. Only a disaster could ruin things now.
We're going to make a change in the back nine pairing, said Carl Bateman. He was sweating despite the cool day.
Three other officials were gathered with him at the registration table.
Carl pulled Scott Hanover out of the first threesome and put a question mark by the three players in the last threesome.
Hanover will go out in a twosome with whomever is closest after the last group makes the turn.
That'll be Patterson, remarked one of the other red-jacketed men.
Could be anybody, warned Carl. No one thought Hanover would be doing this well. He's already holding the tournament record for 9 holes. Heck, it might even be a state record for all I know. Somebody find out.
Another red jacket nodded.
Does anyone know where the USA Sports guy is?
I saw him at the scoreboard 10 minutes ago.
I think his cameraman has been following Hanover all morning. Let's try and make sure he has all the information he needs to get this on the air. Gentlemen, the only thing that could assure us a better chance at airtime tonight would be if Tiger Woods showed up.
All the men looked around hopefully for a second or two.
We should do an equipment check, recommended one of the men.
Didn't someone already do it?
Not on the first 10 threesomes. Heck, nobody thought it would matter with them.
That's all we need. Too many clubs, an illegal driver, or an illegal ball?
We'd have to disqualify the guy, observed Bateman.
All right, we'll pull his caddy aside and do it discreetly after the 9th hole,
ordered Bateman, pointing to the third red jacket.
Call me immediately if there are any problems, and make sure he's filling in his scorecard correctly, too. That's all we need is for him to get disqualified, he said, worrying.
The final threesome of the day is on the tee,
announced the starter.
Mr. Frederick Martin will be first, followed by Carrie Newman and Andrew Patterson. Mr. Martin, whenever you are ready.
Andrew stood confidently. The other two golfers he was with were good, but neither had the ability and self-confidence that Andrew had. He had played with Martin before and knew his weaknesses. Newman was an unknown, but was rated below himself and Martin. It was Andrew's for the taking. A roar erupted from the scoreboard area just as Fred Martin was about to swing. He waited for the murmur to die down, then hit his first drive, long and straight down the middle. Eric Peters whispered into Patterson's ear.
Hanover just saved par on the 8th. He's still at 6 under.
Andrew's expression did not waver. He knew that Hanover must have made some lucky shots in addition to his hole-in-one. But he wasn't going to allow some 20-handicapped golfer's lucky shots destroy his concentration. There was a reason why he had a high handicap, and Andrew knew the bad holes would catch up. While it wasn't unexpected to occasionally shoot one under par, he knew that many amateur golfers tended to explore the upper limits of how far over par they could shoot. 2, 3, or even 4 strokes over was not uncommon. Newman stepped up and cloned Martin's drive with a very full swing. He looked young, perhaps even in his late teens. Not enough maturity and experience to compete at this level, concluded Andrew.
If he keeps it up, he'll set some records, observed Eric quietly.
If you keep it up, I'll have the kid over there carry my bags, responded Andrew.
He hated advice from caddies in general, and absolutely despised talk about anything else. Why were people so excited about a golfer having a few good holes? The round was 18 holes. Consistency and concentration would win the tournament, not lucky shots. Andrew stepped up to take his turn at the tee box. He slid a tee and a brand new ball from his pocket. Leaning lightly on his driver, he inserted the tee with a ball on top of it into the ground. He grasped the club as he always did, set the club head 2 inches behind the ball, drew back, and swung in a beautiful, precise, fluid motion that seemed to negate some of the odd appearance of his golf attire. Despite his eccentric appearance, most of those observing saw he had the skill to back up that eccentricity. His ball also sailed straight, but landed a good 10 yards past the other drives in the middle of the fairway. Andrew had attempted many sports in his life, but none pleased him more than golf. Its many variables and slow speed allowed him to plan for a wide variety of possibilities, and when a shot went as planned, as it did over 90% of the time, it excited him. Putts were the most thrilling part. The more challenging the shot, the better. Sometimes he found himself aiming for difficult positions to try out putts that had several different breaks along their length and required precise knowledge of how the ball would roll and turn. Too much speed and it would miss. Too little, the same. 9 times out of 10, he hit just right. As he and Eric headed down the fairway, he noticed the large crowd gathered around the 9th green. The first group would be coming in now off the back 9. In 2 hours, Hanover would have likely finished his round and be well over par, and Andrew would be 3 under, perhaps 4, if he got a good roll on the 9th tee shot. Then the attention would be on him. It was only natural they lock onto this Hanover fellow now. After all, what was there to do until Andrew teed off?
"Well, Joe, are you glad you made that bet with Patterson now?" Ted asked.
"If only he can keep it up. The other guys with Hanover have had at least one disaster hole each. If he can just limit his bogey holes on the back 9, he might pull it off," answered Joe.
The two men were standing by the 9th tee as Scott Hanover sank his putt on 8. They had witnessed a ball bouncing into the water and figured it was Hanover's, since he would still have honors. Scott's recovery and ability to save par surprised them both. Most golfers would have bogeyed or double bogeyed a hole starting like that. But Scott was able to let it slide right off, and now he was standing on the 9th tee, staring down at the green tucked over to the left of the 450-yard fairway. Joe had seen Scott in frequent consultation with his caddy and assumed he was playing a big role in keeping the amateur on track. A good caddy could make a big difference, Joe had found, if you let him.
"I hope he does win," Ted Lang said. "Hanover winning will do more for the amateur end of the sport than Patterson could."
"Even if he finished second, it'll be the best match I've seen."
"They're having a meeting about pulling Hanover out of the order and letting him pair with the next top golfer after everyone finishes 9,
whispered Ted. "You mean he could go head-to-head with Patterson?"
"If Patterson can come close to 6 under.
That might be too much pressure for Scott. Here he's playing with guys only a little better than him. Once he sees a few of Patterson's arrow straight drives, he'll fall apart."
"If he was going to fall apart, it would have been after he put one in the water," argued Ted.
"True," mused Joe.
"On the other hand, think of the pressure it might put on Patterson."
Joe shook his head in disagreement.
"He's got ice water in his veins. Nothing fazes him. He's got the mental part of the game under control."
"How often has he played against someone who was beating him?"
pointed out Ted. Joe thought it over. "Never, I guess. Do you think it might put some stress on him?"
"He might try to get more aggressive if he needs 1 or 2 more strokes under what he was planning on."
"It will be interesting to see. Would Patterson make any changes to his carefully scripted game if things weren't going as planned? He'd have to depend on some lucky shots, which isn't his style. He knows which greens to 2-putt and which ones to go for it on."
"But despite all his golfing ability," pointed out Ted, "he can't capture that spirit of the game that Scott Hanover has. Patterson likes golf because he's good at it and he can excel. Scott loves golf because it's more fun than frustration. And that, I think, gives him an edge today."
"Just today?"
"Especially today. He has nothing to lose and can walk away happy shooting par. He knows he can have bad holes and expects them. Patterson doesn't even allow for a bad hole. If he had a bogey today, it would devastate him.
Did you ever have a day like Hanover's having? Asked Joe.
Ted smiled.
Every day for the last year, he answered enigmatically.
The hushed conversations around the green quieted down, and Ted and Joe watched as Scott Hanover got ready to hit his drive on the ninth hole.
Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you are interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, Cozy Mysteries about a Crime-Solving Veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.